Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Truth and Movies. Today, post-Thanksgiving, James Franco reheats Old Turkey in epic reenactment of Tommy Wiseau's The Room, widely regarded as worst film ever made that wasn't called Transformers something. Also, Blade of the Immortal, Takashi Miike, with more cuts than a Republican tax plan, a similarly feudal worldview, and as much regard for ordinary people's healthcare. Meanwhile, The Room, worst film ever, Hold My Beer, says this week's Film Club, as we saw with Bruce Willis's ego in Hudson Hawk. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. On board today's Truth and Movies, we've got Adam Woodward.
Hello.
And just Adam Woodward.
Yes.
And we're awfully sorry. Beth Webb was meant to be with us. There was a mix-up with the time. Whose fault was that, Adam?
Totally, completely, 100% our fault.
No, it was my fault,
actually.
Your fault. It was my fault.
But I was willing to take part of the hit.
No, you're here, listener, and that's the main thing. At least I think you are. Anyway, now, Nick wrote in, talking about Wonder, actually. He says, I saw Wonder on Sunday night, took my 9-year-old daughter. She loved the book. And Nick thought the film was fine, but his biggest issue was the way that the affluence of everyone involved inoculated everyone from reality, taking place in some magical fairyland version of New York. This was something that Hannah, I think, was touching on a little bit, the way that it wanted to talk about issues, but without ever getting into the gritty reality of it. Mm. Alex comments on our message board about the films you'd see just for the actor debate that we were having. They agree with Sam Rockwell and nominate Woody Harrelson, who's developed into a supremely watchable actor. But top of the pile, says Alex, is Tommy Lee Jones. What an actor, what a face. Alex then suggests, Adam, Three Burials of Miliciadus Estrada for Film Club. Doesn't do a very good job of selling it, because Alex goes on to say it's a flawed film with poor pace and it's a bit anticlimactic. But it does illustrate my point perfectly.
Right. So his point is that Tommy Lee Jones is able to elevate even sort of substandard material.
Yeah, I guess so.
I had a little
Tommy Lee Jones's face.
Yeah, just his face. I had a little look back through his filmography.
Ah.
And, I mean, he's been in some amazing films, but I think the last really, really great one that he did was called In the Valley of Ella.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if you ever saw
that.
Really good.
Did you have any thoughts on Wonder? Because, of course, I breezed past that one. You weren't here with us last week.
I regret to say I haven't got around to seeing it yet.
Dimitro Deminski has written in largely for the pleasure of hearing me try to pronounce his name. We'll be having further attempts at that, no doubt, in future weeks. But for now, he says, in the light of recent events, should we consider Netflix Icarus as film of the year? And are there any good political films, not documentaries or detective ones like All the President's Men? I couldn't think of many. However, I do not watch movies for a living, says Dimitro.
Well, funnily enough, I was just talking to producer Ian about Icarus before we came in here. And we're putting together our top tens for the year at the moment. And I think it may well sneak into mine. It's quite a remarkable film.
Excellent.
All about kind of cycling and doping and goes into all sorts of crazy territory. So, yeah, worth checking out.
Ever so topical. Very good. We are going to be moving on to film number one for us this week, The Disaster Artist, after this. The Disaster Artist, James Franco's reenactment of The Room, not the Jacob Tremblay, Brie Larson kidnapped family drama, but the utterly bizarre film produced by the weird and mysterious Tommy Wiseau. This film telling the story of how Tommy meets up with his soon-to-be BFF Greg Sestero, and together they make their Hollywood dreams come true. Here is Tommy walking in on Greg and his new girlfriend.
Tommy, hey.
Hey.
What's this? This is Amber, who I was telling you about.
Oh, girlfriend.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I don't have time for this. I'm very busy right now. I have to change really quickly and go.
Okay, is everything all right?
Yeah, everything great on my end. You heard of Konstantin Stanislavski?
Of course, yeah. He's like the greatest acting teacher of all time.
Yeah, and now he taught me acting teacher. He seemed something special in me, you know, maybe, you know, I'll become a big star. So I have first class this evening.
Well, pretty sure Stanislavski's dead.
No, he's not dead. I just speak to him for your information. What, do you think I speak to ghosts?
No.
Okay, I'll let you know how it is, baby face. Maybe you can join me someday.
Maybe I will.
Not so good.
I'm so sorry. Maybe I'm baby face.
Tommy Wiseau then, an astonishing impression as the film makes plain in its closing credits when it has a kind of side-by-side run of Tommy Wiseau, the original, and James Franco's version of him. Why is Tommy Wiseau's The Room regarded as the worst film ever?
I guess it's one of those films that's just so bizarre and so singular at the same time. There's an amazing story behind it, and this film, The Disaster Artist, is based in part on a book, a kind of account written by Greg Sestero, who is Tommy Wiseau's long-suffering friend and co-star in The Room. And, you know, it's this sort of Hollywood myth, really. It's just like a modern myth, and I think the film, the original film, The Room was made in 2003, although as we see here, it took them quite a long time to actually make it. It was completely self-funded by Tommy Wiseau. People may remember the famous billboard that he had put up on Sunset Boulevard that was there for like 5 years or something, which James Franco has replicated, and he has his own one up there now. And it's just a kind of fascinating bit of an underdog story, I guess. But the real myth of the film is all around Tommy Wiseau. I mean, there's all this stuff about who he is. No one really knows how old he is, where he's from. He has this bizarre accent. And
where his money's from.
Where his money's from, because the budget for The Room is estimated to be around $6 million or something. A wonderful bit in this, actually, when they finally get around to deciding they're going to make the film, they go to somewhere to hire some kit, like lights and cameras and all that stuff, and they decide they're just going to go and buy it all like outright, even though it doesn't really make any sense to, because they're just making this one movie. But that's, you know, Tommy's idea of how to make a film, and this is what you need to do if you're going to be a big Hollywood director. And it's kind of a beautiful story, actually. And I saw a fascinating interview on might have been Jimmy Fallon or Kimmel or one of those guys, and James Franco was basically saying, you know, plenty of people talk about making movies and they just sit around and it's a pipe dream that never comes to fruition. And actually, Tommy, for better and for worse, actually did it. He made his sort of dream come true, and fair play to him.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting balance, isn't it, between celebrating the fact that he actually went out there and made his movie and also illustrating to the audience just what an awful movie he made. And I'm not sure if it manages it all the way through. While I hugely enjoyed The Disaster Artist, I was left a little bit troubled by the end. Franco's direction, though, and he is an actor who, he likes to play the kind of good time guy. A lot of his film choices are very much the stoner end of the market. But this is a very well-directed film.
It is. I mean, it really shows his capacity as a director to put himself in the movie as well. I mean, he is doing this amazing impersonation. If you've never seen The Room before, and frankly, I don't really recommend anyone to check it out, because the stuff around the film, the story about it, is much more interesting than the actual film. But yeah, Franco gives this amazing impersonation, and the idea that he, you know, has been quite, I guess, single-minded in bringing this film together is in a way a sort of loose parallel of what happened with Tommy. And obviously Franco is an established movie star, so it's a lot easier for him. And I think he gets the balance right for me in terms of the telling the story and also not completely crapping on Tommy Wiseau and The Room. I mean, it's quite affectionate, I think, in his portrayal. It doesn't necessarily pull any punches, but he's not, I don't think it's overly sneering or dismissive of him.
Well, Tommy Wiseau and, to an extent, Greg Sestero, who wrote the kind of tell-all memoir of the film being made, have turned what was originally intended to be a serious film into almost a deliberately bad... I mean, they're now living off its awfulness to an extent. And Tommy Wiseau's certainly been quite involved in the publicity for this film. I did enjoy this film tremendously. It's very, very funny. And Franco, I think, is amazing. His impersonation of Tommy Wiseau, as you say, without, it's not a slapstick impersonation. There is affection in there. but is absolutely note perfect. And there's an extended sequence, for me a little bit overextended, in the end credits, as I say, when they just do a split screen with their version of the room and the original side by side, and it's essentially the same movie.
It's funny to watch. I mean, that for me was the best part of the film, actually. It's funny to watch that, knowing how excruciating the original film was for everyone else involved, all the crew, all the cast. I mean, you see it in this film, the behind the scenes where he would be doing 50, 60 takes just because he was so bad at delivering or even remembering his lines, for instance. Paralleling that with the obvious enjoyment that they had making The Disaster Artist. I mean, you can kind of see, or you get a sense of how fun it must have been to recreate those scenes.
Well, he's got his brother on board. The first time, curiously, that Dave and James Franco have appeared in the same film. Seth Rogen also turning up, doing sterling work as a man who actually knows about movie making and can't quite believe what he's witnessing. As I say, the one qualm I had, I think it comes down to this. Franco is very much part of the Hollywood establishment. He's got his own game going on, and he's very much at the centre of that. And there's a slight sense by the end that while they dress it up as a celebration of a man who actually, there's a speech in the premiere of The Room at the end where Dave says to James, it doesn't matter that everyone's laughing at your film. Because you actually went out there and made this movie. Yeah. But there's a slight sense of the Hollywood establishment laughing at the hick who thought he could come to town and make a movie. But it is a tremendously entertaining watch.
And I think, people, are sincere in their enjoyment of The Room, whether it's because it's so bad that it's actually good. I mean,
I'm not sure that helps. If you make a movie, does it matter that people are enjoying it because you made it so badly?
It's interesting. I think you'd have to question what Tommy's original intention was with the movie, because actually he's making something which is very earnest. He's inspired by, like, old James Dean movies and things like that. He thinks he's making a serious sort of drama, I suppose. And ultimately, I think the fact that so many people have taken so much joy from it is a positive thing. And there's a reason the film The Room still packs out screenings at, like, the Prince Charles in London, and it has this global fan base now that a lot of bad films obviously don't get. I don't know why this was kind of singled out. I guess the character, the main person driving the whole thing, is just such a weird character.
He's so enigmatic.
Even now, I mean, we're talking about the enigma around his age and where he's from. No one really knows. I mean, even James Franco spent a lot of time with him. Doesn't really know, or at least he's not giving anything away.
Well, yeah, I imagine somebody must know, but I think it probably works in The Disaster Artist's favour that he remains this great, vaguely Bela Lugosi-esque mystery. Franco described the script as a cross between Boogie Nights and The Master, which of course were both the PTA movies.
I think that's a little bit of a stretch. I mean, I did enjoy this film. I don't think it ever reaches that point where it's saying something more profound about the industry, or, about the idea of, like, enigmatic, almost cult figures. This works on a very meta, but also quite kind of superficial level for me, and not much deeper than that.
Right. We're famed for our use of the word glib in here.
Are we?
Would this be a good time to bust it out or not?
Go for it.
No, that was all I was going to say. Forget that bit. I wonder if, off the back of this, anyone's going to go to Tommy Wiseau and say, here's a fat budget, well, not that he'd need one. What next can you come up with? Because there's going to be so much notoriety for him and his movie, The Room 2.
I mean, it's been a very much a cult thing and an underground thing, I suppose, for quite a long time. And people within the industry know it, but people in the wider film world and general public maybe don't know it. So this is, for many people, will be an introduction to that. I wonder if he will just ride that way for a longer period.
But
maybe we'll have a Room 2, I don't know. I'd be surprised. I mean, I think he's probably at a point now where he can just kind of keep doing, appearances at room screenings. But
in this film, he's burning with such a desire to become first an actor and then a director, but basically make movies, that living off one movie from 15 years ago, I wonder if he'd be tempted. But anyway, we're flying off on a tangent there. Give this some scores, Adam.
I think I would go for a 3 for anticipation, just because... Yeah, I've seen The Room, but I haven't, like, it doesn't hold a special place in my heart, frankly. And James Franco can be a bit hit or miss, I think, as a director more than an actor. But I'd say 4 at the time, and then possibly a 3 afterwards.
I was hugely looking forward to this. I'd seen the trailer, which is pretty much just one of the choice moments from the film played out straight, which is the rooftop scene, "I did not hit her." Tommy Wiseau's repeated attempts to capture that line. The film, as I say, was very entertaining at the time. I'd probably give it a 4. Afterwards, 3 or a 2. slightly sat uneasy with me, this kind of celebration of awfulness and the fact that the film's a little bit trying to have its cake and eat it too. There's a lot of that about at the moment in terms of making a movie out of how bad somebody else was at making a movie. But then at the end, having a little bit of a, it doesn't matter because, you know, every loser wins, everybody gets a medal.
I think the biggest selling point for this film is that James Franco has gone in with a view to just making something that is entertaining and is fun and does kind of celebrate and share that joy and the revelry of the room and everything that came after it. So I think he does that quite well.
Mm. Good. Awesome. Well, that's The Disaster Artist. Next up, plenty more people dying on screen in Blade of the Immortal. Blade of the Immortal, everybody, which is the, Adam, 100th film from Takashi Miike? Is that right?
Miike, I think Miike? So, yeah.
All right, apologies if I got that wrong. It stars Takuya Kimura as Manji, who's a highly skilled samurai who becomes cursed with immortality after a pretty legendary battle. Lovely battle in black and white at the start of the film. Years later, haunted by the death of his sister, Manji meets a young girl who reminds him enormously of her, and he ends up becoming her bodyguard. She seeks revenge against a group of master swordsmen, the Iturui, who themselves possess skills that do seem otherworldly.
Hmm.
How much did you enjoy this one, Adam?
Yeah, he's sort of flirting with the supernatural a little bit here, which he's not always done. It's a return to the Shogun era for Miike, and as you say, his 100th film is by far, I think, Japan's most prolific director. Not all of his films are worth watching, I will say that. I think this is probably his best since 13 Assassins, which is similarly quite brutal and, you know, 100 miles a minute.
Really. Is it shorter?
Actually, I think 13 Assassins is like 3 hours.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's really long. It's a proper, like, epic.
Okay.
I mean, like, Kurosawa levels.
Right. Yeah, this is 2.25 hours, I think.
Yeah, I don't think this... it didn't feel particularly long to me. I would say I love the characters. I think the little girl especially, who he sort of takes under his wing, is brilliant. To me, it's very entertaining in the moment. The fight scenes are just... he's an amazing choreographer of these action sequences. I think it so bludgeons you, though, with that. After a while, it kind of wore me down to the point where, I mean, the bodies keep piling up, and it is quite a kind of violent and gory film, obviously, but, yeah, really, it really started to lose its effect on me towards the end.
Is there any... has anyone done a study of how many people actually get chopped to pieces
on the
in
actual
film?
Body count?
Yeah.
No, but if anyone out there is willing to tally that up for us, I'd be fascinated.
It's certainly in three figures, isn't it?
I would imagine so. But I mean, it's one of those where it's almost preposterous that he's... okay, he's introduced as a legendary samurai, but there's like, he'll be in the middle of a pile of people and he'll just be single-handedly, you know, batting them away. Mm. And
often single-handedly because they've chopped his other one off.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And we should say the supernatural element is essentially these magic worms that live inside him that essentially make him immortal, as per the title.
Keep his weight down as well.
Yeah, yeah.
He's great, actually. I enjoyed Takuya Kimura as Manji. This is quite kind of deadpan. Was there a slight Leon element to this, you know, echoing last week's film club? You have an assassin, albeit one with worms, and a young waif whose family's been slaughtered.
I hadn't picked up on that, but I think you're spot on there, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. As you say, his choreography is extraordinary. In fact, there's one point, I'd say one point, that the big finale, without giving anything away, he says, "You enjoy me choreographing a massive sword fight? Yeah. All right, I'll do two at once and have them both in frame, one foreground, one background." It's extraordinary. But I do entirely take your point that after a while, seeing people being slashed to pieces with a katana, I think that's right, does get a little repetitive.
I think he does something really beautiful and slightly unexpected with the very last climactic fight sequence, because suddenly the whole scene and atmosphere of the film drops a level and the music cuts out, and I wonder whether that is actually him kind of setting it up, like, you've got to this point in the film, you've gone through this incredibly brutal journey and bruising journey, and you're so kind of worn down. I did feel actually quite physically fatigued from it, and I wonder whether that was Miike kind of saying, you know, there's this certain futility about about basically what happens at the end. And I thought that was like a really beautiful moment. The end fight is nothing really like the ones that have come before it.
That's true. And the narrative as well throughout, and a lot of the dialogue, is continually undercutting the notion of there being a good v evil struggle going on. It's a much more nuanced story than that. I'm not familiar with, to be fair, any of the cast.
Right.
But I particularly enjoyed the member of the Iturriu who appears as a monk at one point.
Oh, yeah, he's particularly good.
Mm.
He's just got a really amazing eye for visuals as well and, like, iconography. And he really, Mika really understands, you know, the history of this samurai world, I guess. But he also modernises it in an interesting way. And there's a few nice things in there. Like, there's a recurring thing where he takes the end of his samurai sword and kind of turns it into a double-ended
Darth Maul,
Phantom Menace style, which I'm sure Phantom Menace probably borrowed it from old samurai tradition. Maybe that existed back then, but yeah, it ends up with this like double-headed sword, which is just, yeah, it's a really cool moment, I think, in the film.
Tremendous storyline to this as well. Bloodworms and this wonderful group, the Iturriu. Very interesting. Numbers then, Adam?
Yeah, I think probably three for me, actually. I do like Mika, but again, he is quite hit and miss.
Right.
And, you know, 13 Assassins I absolutely love. He made a film after that called Harakiri, which is essentially a samurai movie without any sword fighting in it, which bored me to tears.
Wow.
And so I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I think the posters and, you know, the marketing for this have suggested something a bit more brutal. So I was kind of looking forward to it. And a 4 at the time and probably a 3 in retrospect.
Okay. All right. But you would say that 13 Assassins is the Mika to seek out.
Yeah, if you are a connoisseur of samurai movies, I would recommend this. I think 13 Assassins is probably like his masterpiece.
Okay. If you found this one slightly repetitive with the slashing, would you have issues with 13 Assassins?
I think what's great about 13 Assassins is it follows in the kind of samurai or Kurosawa samurai tradition of making these like epically mounted, epically scaled movies where it is the whole Magnificent Seven Samurai thing of a troop coming together and you get this sense of their journey and the real action takes place at the end. I mean, I think probably 30% of the movie is one fight scene the whole film builds towards. And it is just spectacular when it arrives because he just teases it and sets it up for so long. Whereas this is sort of the opposite of that. I mean, you're straight in with the fight scenes.
Yeah, and it glorious really black and white sequence at the start.
Yeah.
I give this a 3. I mean, the title's pretty intriguing, Blade of the Immortal. Mm. Didn't know anything really about Mika or his work. At the time, probably a 3 and 3 afterwards. I mean, I thought it was a gorgeous film to watch. It's beautiful to look at. It's quite otherworldly.
Mm.
But there is an element of drudgery about the magnificent swordplay, essentially for Manji getting through 100 or so soldiers. He dispatched them with more or less the same way that you and I would get through the kind of morning commute or something. It's, oh, God, here's another 100 soldiers. Bang, 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 bang. The bloodworms and his immortality doesn't help tremendously with the sense of tension about any of the sword fights he gets into. But that said, as I say, Mika brings plenty of other nuances into play behind the simple kind of sword duels. So, yeah, a 3. And if you like seeing people hacked to death, this is very much a movie for you.
I would say if you like things like Tarantino movies, this is probably for you. A film I'd recommend from a few years ago, The Assassin, is more my kind of cup of tea when it comes to these movies.
Which was a much slower film.
A lot slower, but just every, you know, frame is a painting. It's absolutely beautiful.
Right.
And the female protagonist in it is extraordinary as well.
I found that a very confusing film, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I think you need to really pay attention and watch it maybe 2 or 3 times, but it's, yeah, worth the payoff, I think.
Okay. This one's more fun than The Assassin. If you've seen The Assassin, I'm going to say this one's more fun. All right, excellent. On next to our Little White Lies Film Club.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In honor of James Franco's resurrection of Tommy Wiseau and his The Room, widely regarded as the worst film ever made, it's kind of actually its shtick by now.
I think it's trademarked that, isn't it?
We asked listeners to come up with their worst films ever, see if there's one that maybe justified a little bit of a revisit. We seem to have ended up, although we managed to not tell anyone about it last week, with Hudson Hawk. Here's a little clip of Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhardt doing their supervillain thing.
Jam-packed with such idiots.
Every schmo has the fantasy that the planet revolves around them. It rains, a car crash stops traffic, you say, how can this happen to me? But for us, this isn't a fantasy, it is a reality.
Oh yes! If Da Vinci was alive today, he'd be eating microwave sushi naked in the back of a Cadillac with the both of us. The project of his life is now the toy of mine. History, tradition, culture are not concepts. These are trophies I keep in my den as paperweights. Chaos will cause the world with this machine will be our final masterpiece.
Watch out for that falling column, Andy McDowell. What did they make of this, Adam?
Yeah, we separated this into the good, the bad and the meh. It really was quite a divisive film, I think, and for good reason. Plenty of people getting in touch. Kat Andreyko on the good column says, it's flawed but fun film of its time. Michael Thompson says, I love it, but then I'd watch Brucey painting his living room and enjoy
really?
It. Yeah. A certain David Jenkins describes it as 18 garbage fires, all circling one massive out-of-control garbage fire in the middle. Which I presume he is referring to Bruce Willis's performance there. Caroline Eastwood, only film I've ever fallen asleep during.
Really?
Which is quite surprising,
I am
think.
Surprised by that, Caroline.
The Mayor, someone describes it as, has its moments, but is it a bit off somehow?
Yeah, which is probably fair. Mark Kermode likes this film, and he met Richard E. Grant and told him that he was one of the few people who enjoyed Hudson Hawk. Grant's response was, it was a stinking pile of steaming hot donkey droppings and you are an idiot. So there you go.
Well, Richard E. Grant dedicated a chapter of his memoir to this film, which I haven't read, but I'm going to go and seek
it out. Wow, I think having sat through Hudson Hawk, I'm eager to know what Mr. Grant has to say about it. Well, if you didn't manage to catch Hudson Hawk, you're missing out, actually, on a great lost slice of what I assumed was 80s... movie making, but it's actually from the 90s, in the same way that the 70s kind of spiraled on a little bit to the
80s. Yeah, it spills over a little bit.
This, and I think The Last Action Hero really kind of marked the end of the 80s.
Well, it's from 1991, but it feels like
was
an 80s.
Yeah,
it feels
okay.
Like an 80s movie.
Oh, okay. It tells the story of Eddie Hawkins, a.k.a. the Hudson Hawk, who's just been released from 10 years of prison. He's planning to spend his life honestly, but just when he thought he was out, the world's greatest cat burglar is drawn back in for what you'd have to describe as his wildest job ever.
Yeah, all he wants is a cappuccino.
Ha! Yeah.
I mean, we could go on and try and describe the plot, but really I think it would be...
It's an interesting plot. I would actually really like to see this movie remade with a sensible director and a slightly less smirksome central character.
I think we should tell a bit of the story of how this
go
film
on,
came
then.
About.
So this was an idea that actually came from Bruce Willis himself in conjunction with his friend Robert Kraft.
Robert Kraft, the musician, who the story goes that Robert Kraft was playing a gig in possibly New York or Chicago or somewhere, and Bruce Willis was a bartender and struggling actor at the time, and joined in a song, basically came on stage with his harmonica and started playing along. And the two sparked up a friendship, and one of the songs that Robert Kraft had at the time was called The Hudson Hawk, and somehow this idea of a cat burglar called The Hudson Hawk grew out of that. This film is Bruce Willis's first and, dare I say, final screenwriting credit. So he gets a story credit on it, but basically his stock was pretty high at this point in Hollywood. He'd made Die Hard, Die Hard 2, Bonfire of the Vanities had just come out, and I think when they were making this, it screen tested and Bruce Willis's character was supposedly getting good reactions. So they decided that although Willis initially had a small part in Hudson Hawk, after that they were going to give him a much bigger role and essentially base the film around him. So it's a curious one, but it's the ultimate vanity project, I think, and a great case study of what happens when basically no one's saying no to you.
Including the director, Michael Lehman, whose stock, similarly to Bruce Willis, was pretty high at the time after his directorial effort to Heathers.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's someone who was an up-and-coming director. He'd made Heathers, Meet the Applegates also in 91. Mm. This is very much his first foray into blockbuster territory, and it's quite telling that he never made another film on this scale afterwards. It's a fascinating, you know, relic of its time. It doesn't really hold up, but then I don't think it ever made sense at the time either. So it's a strange one. I mean, the casting choice of Bruce Willis itself makes a lot of sense, but then when you pair him with, say, Andie MacDowell, who I think was cast very last minute,
right,
she clearly doesn't really grasp the character or the film that she's in. You can kind of see her really struggling with where to kind of pitch the character. But then you've got Danny Aiello, who's very funny, I think, and his chemistry with Bruce Willis is actually quite good.
Did you think so? I thought that was one of the issues with the film, that it's a comedy that's not very funny, and it's a buddy movie where they didn't seem to be particularly buddies either. Mm. I mean, they might have. It, for me, their on-screen chemistry was on a par with Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney in Ebony and Ivory, when you remember they filmed their bits separately and were just edited in post.
Well, apparently they're friends in real life,
right?
And they had a genuine.
Well, that's my mistake then. I read that completely wrong.
Oh yeah, well maybe you'd never know, but then yeah, then you have Richard E. Grant really hamming it up as a sort of supervillain, and Sandra Bernhard, who you know we praised so much in an earlier film club when we talked about The King of Comedy and how great she's there, and yeah, I think she's pretty terrible in this.
Strident.
I don't think anyone really comes off.
Well, Richard E. Grant is fun.
He's kind of fun. I think,
and I thought Andie MacDowell was okay, actually.
Yeah.
But it is a very confused film, tonally speaking, and I think that the longer it goes on, the more it becomes so. I mean, it's essentially Dan Brown meets the Three Stooges. Could we say that?
I like the Dan Brown reference.
But, I mean, some of the slapstick, there's a fight scene towards the end, which is very much Three Stooges. And I think there's an attempt to reference that. I mean, Willis himself says that, here's a quote from Bruce Willis. He says, it has very intellectual hip humour in it, he says of his own screenplay. It has very sophomoric, broad slapstick comedy. It has elements of a road picture. It has more romance than any film that I have ever done. It has action. It has big stunts. It has a very dark sensibility. It is a film that needs to be experienced more than explained.
Yeah, it is a difficult one to explain, to be fair. It's a strange one. I think that ultimately it isn't even necessarily a product of its time, but it is something that you don't get anymore. I mean, Hollywood is kind of averse to making these, like, what we call now as a medium-sized blockbuster-style movie of $60, $70 million budget. And Hudson Hawk, you have to say, is part of the reason maybe why those films don't exist anymore.
Hmm. It wasn't in vain, then?
Well, no, I mean, I would say that I would much rather see a film like Hudson Hawk being made today than, say, a new Die Hard movie.
Interesting. Certainly more than a new Transformers film. And
exactly,
at least a lot of imagination. And as I say, a really interesting plot. I would love to see, you can imagine, Indiana Jones-style exploration of somebody going around using Da Vinci's inventions and devices and art to get towards some massive kind of MacGuffin-esque
I think Willis
finale.
Thinks he's playing an Indiana Jones-style character, doesn't he? And yeah, his ego does basically spoil, I think, everything that's good about this film. There is some enjoyable moments in it. There's a quirkiness to it and a kind of what the hell is happening and where are we going with this feeling.
And it's
when
got James
it.
Coburn in it, which is never a bad thing.
There's some nice little subtle references to his earlier films as well. You know the strange like ringtone. It's also referenced in Austin Powers.
Okay.
People, if they know Austin Powers well, you'll know, but it's that kind of throwback to the James Coburn, like, spy movies.
Oh, in like Flint?
Exactly,
things.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's some nice, you know, there's an idea that they know what they're doing with it. And the thing I think is amazing about Hudson Hawk is it's so confident in itself. Even though it's completely lunatic, it seems to think that what it's doing is exactly the right thing. And Willis was basically responsible for a lot of the rewrites in the script that were happening as they were filming.
Mm.
The story goes that, you know, basically, as I say, no one was saying no to him. So he would suggest something and the director would be kind of forced to alter the script at Willis's whim. He's notoriously difficult to work with, apparently. So
James Coburn's character, by the way, named George Kaplan, which I hardly need point out, is the name of the fake agent in North by Northwest. Other character names include the Mario Brothers, entertainingly. As you say, its confidence is its strength. I thought more so at the start. The longer it goes on, the more the whole kind of on-set meddling boils over and it collapses like a giant souffle.
And it is an hour and 40 minutes, but it feels quite long for that. But no, Willis is a curious Hollywood star, and you know, you can kind of look back at his career and say, was this where it started to kind of go wrong for him a little bit? I mean, I think it is quite telling that he started making things like Die Hard sequels and essentially sub Die Hard rip-offs as well. I mean, do some reading on like Cop Out, a film he made with Kevin Smith a few years ago, and apparently he was notoriously difficult to work with on that. And I think it was the fourth Die Hard movie where he was having some, there was a lot of on-set tension between him and the director, and it got to the point where Bruce Willis says something like, "Oh, tell me, who is your second choice for John McClane?" You know, that's his attitude, and it really shines through here. And I think, as much as I like Bruce Willis as a persona, as a presence on screen, but I think, yeah, he's very much been his own downfall.
All right. Well, what are we going to be doing for Film Club next week?
Well, next week is Star Wars week.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd revisit Rian Johnson, I think it is, his first film, Brick.
Yeah, which is tremendous.
Which
film.
Is really, really terrific film from, I think, 2005, I want to say. I'm not sure how many people really know of it. It's got a young Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It's a really fantastic kind of teen neo-noir. Isn't really nothing quite like it. And yeah, it's the sort of thing that if he'd have made that now, he'd be making Star Wars like tomorrow. But it's fascinating that he's taken a long time to kind of get to this point of, you know, making a big movie. But it's terrific to revisit.
I really screwed up.
Screwed up how?
The brick.
What?
I didn't know it was bad, but the pin's on it now. You gotta help me.
Slow down now. This isn't good.
No.
Emily said words I didn't know. Tell me if they catch.
Brick?
No.
Tug?
Tug might be a drink, like milk and vodka.
Pin?
You know the kingpin.
Dope robber, right?
Big time. What are you gonna do?
She asked for my help. I just wanna know she's okay.
So what's first?
I'm gonna start shaking things up.
So next week we're going to be doing Brick as our film club, and then the two films being reviewed are, well, Mountains Made Apart, we'll be reviewing that, but I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with us actually reviewing a Star Wars film. I think a Star Wars film comes out and you watch. For example, is David in next week?
It's you, David, and Michael next week.
Oh, dear. What if he doesn't like it?
Do you know what? Well, David's liked, I think he really enjoyed The Force Awakens, and we both love Rogue One. So
good.
I think, we're Team Star Wars.
Okay. Fingers crossed, eh? Fingers crossed. Do get watching Brick anyway. Let us know your thoughts. Our email remains truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. On Twitter, we're at LWLies. You can find us on Facebook, or the Little White Lies website has a special podcast section with comments enabled on it. While we're on the subject of things starry, how about that business of J.J. Abrams and Quentin Tarantino teaming up for the next Star Trek flick?
Yeah, has that been... What's the sort of scoop on that? Has it
been confirmed? I have no idea. I was going to ask you, Adam.
Well, Tarantino's sort of on the record saying that he would love to direct a Star Trek film, and he's had an idea knocking around for one for a long time, and I don't know whether it's just a resurfacing of that story or whether there's something more to it. But
I really hope it's not. I've been really disappointed by the Star Trek reboot. I think a lot of the ideas have been good in terms of what they wanted to do, but the storyline has been a little bit lazy.
Are you Team Star Trek or Star Wars?
Oh, very much Team Star Wars, but you know, nothing against Star Trek, but I'm not in any shape or
Trekkie. Can you be both? I didn't think you could be both.
Well, no, indeed. They've even had fights on Hollywood Boulevard, haven't they? Well, we'll see. We'll see when confirmation comes of Tarantino's involvement or not of that. Anything else you'd like to mention, though, Adam?
Well, the only slight plug for this week, I'm sure David won't mind me saying that our next print issue, well, we're working on it at the moment, and Guillermo del Toro's new film, The Shape of Water, is on the cover. But it's actually, the film's being released in the US this week.
Right.
And to celebrate, we've commissioned a video essay by a very talented Luis Azevedo, who makes terrific video essays. Did one for us on Christopher Nolan and one on AI around the release of Blade Runner as well. And this one looks at Guillermo del Toro's use of objects and how he uses artifacts and little motifs to kind of tell the story, you know, connect the characters and the audience in that way. So, yeah, it's terrific. It will be hopefully online later today, so do check it out.
Okay. In addition to all of this, I've been tremendously enjoying Jim and Andy, the behind-the-scenes diary, almost, of what happened when they made Man on the Moon. Have we talked about that here before?
I don't know that we have, but it's...
No, we haven't, but it's really worth catching.
It's better than the film Man on the Moon, I think.
Well, I really enjoyed Man on the Moon, and as a result, I'm really enjoying this, but I'm not sure how many films get made in this fashion. Very few, I would think, but it's a very interesting window. It does seem to be opening up about the whole creative process in a way that you rarely see.
Yeah, it gave me a new appreciation of that film, and also Carey's, the way he kind of inhabited the character of Andy Kaufman is quite extraordinary. And for anyone listening who hasn't...
Or the way that Andy Kaufman inhabited him.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, he does play that up to a point where you're like, okay, you're selling this quite well. But then, you know, you have all this amazing footage that they filmed at the time, behind the scenes stuff, and which is the base of this film. And it's quite fascinating.
Mm. Good. Well, that's on Netflix at the moment, as are a bunch of other things. Monday night, we'll catch Star Wars. We'll let you know our thoughts next week. Do have yourselves a very special weekend, whatever it is you're watching. By the way, what is Mountains May Depart?
Oh, it's a new Zha Zhang Ke film, Chinese director. I think it's screened...
For anyone out there going, Zha Zhang, he's not the guy from the Phantom Menace, is he?
No, sadly not. He's a very good Chinese art house director.
Right.
I think it's screened or premiered in the Cannes Film Festival, not this year, but the year before. For a long time, didn't look like it was going to get a UK release, but it's finally been picked up, and it's definitely worth checking out. But I'll leave it for you guys to discuss next week.
Adam, thank you very much. Have yourself a super weekend then, listeners, whatever it is that you're enjoying. And we'll catch up with you next week with those movies. For now, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.